people. All right. So I thought we would spend a little time on questions from last week and related things that I think are interesting, and then maybe go on to a sort of a summary discussion of issues that I think the course has raised that apply across different forms of IP. And for people who I was discussing before some of you came in because it hadn't started yet, the plans for the rest of the semester, which is basically that between now and Tuesday, I will try to read a significant number of your papers, not all of them at that point, but at least, you know, 5 or 6 or 7, and choose at least 3 that look really interesting to me, web those 3, and put on the syllabus links to those 3 for Thursday's class, for a class a week from now. That's the basic plan. And then your obligation each week is going to be to read the papers that have been webbed for that day. And then the author of the paper will come in and not read the paper because you've already read it, but rather talk about the paper a little bit, but mostly discuss the paper. So that mostly, let me repeat some of what I was saying when only a few people were here, but there are basically 2 models in the academic world for presenting a paper that I've observed. The crazy model, which is the usual one, consists of professor from some other school who's written an interesting paper, comes to Stanford or to here or to Chicago, and in a room full of other people interested in the subject, spends 45 minutes reading the paper to them. Usually not quite verbatim, but almost, and then half an hour discussing it, if you're lucky. The other model, which I think of as the Chicago model, because I think that's where it originated and it was fairly common, which is the sane model, is that everybody in the workshop has agreed, implicitly or explicitly, to read the paper in advance. The person whose paper it is gets 15 or 20 minutes in which he can talk about the paper, anything he likes, but he's not trying to summarize it, which he couldn't do it in 15 or 20 minutes, and all the rest is a free-for-all. And when it works very well. When it works, it's the closest thing to thinking in more than one brain that I've seen. And I was hoping to reconstruct some of that effect here for our papers. So think of your obligation, if you didn't write the paper, as both destructive and constructive criticism. That is, you both want to be able to say, here is something which you thought was unconvincing or was wrong, but also, here is a way you could have expanded the arguments, some additional evidence for what you're saying that hadn't occurred to you, a different interesting topic you might want to explore because it's part of your subject and so forth. So think of it that your objective really is to make it a better paper. Right? And then the author is going to be here presumably defending his arguments, explaining his arguments, saying, well, yeah, that is a good idea. You know, why don't I do that? And so forth, whatever the author feels like doing along those lines. I don't know if we'll get through 3 papers a day. I haven't actually calculated how many of the papers we will get through, but I figure that we're unlikely to get through more than 3, and if we get through 2, then the third one can just be the first one for the next class. All right? Any questions on that procedure? No. All right. I intend, of course, to read and comment on all of the papers, and how large a fraction of the papers we'll get through, I don't know. But I think it's an advantage if your paper does get presented here, because then you get other people's ideas as well as my ideas on it. All right. So, as per my usual strategy, do you have questions from last week, since we don't have a reading for this week, on trademark? Yes? Yes, I'm going to. That's on my outline of things I want to discuss on that. So yes, you're right. No, and the Lippman piece is very interesting, and she's bright and sort of interesting person. And but I think part of it is probably wrong, though I may be mistaken. Anyway, on advertising, people want to say something. All right, let me start with something which is sort of tangential and applies to a lot more than this class, but I think is interesting. And that's the question of sizes, of magnitudes. So suppose we're talking about advertising. It matters a good deal whether the total expenditure of firms on advertising is 1% of their total revenue or 50% of their total revenue. And so the question is, which is it? And I therefore suggest as an interesting project for you, since you all have internet access as well as a library, see if you can work out a very rough estimate of what fraction of the cost of products is advertising. All right? And there are 2 entirely different strategies that you could use for doing that. One of them is to go online or into the library and see if there are studies that give figures or if there are published statistics. You can look at, my guess is, the Statistical Abstract of the U.S., which is the first place I look for things like that, which I'm pretty sure is webbed at this point, probably has some sort of a breakdown that you get great number of numbers. The other thing to do is to see if you can deduce it from evidence you yourself observe. So that one of the things that you might try doing is, in the next couple of times you're in a grocery store, compare house brand products with trade brand products. Because presumably I would guess, now maybe the house brand, they may do some advertising too, but my guess would be that what you have there are very similar products, one of which is a nationally advertised brand name and people value for that reason, another which is pretty similar. Now, ideally, it should be a product that you use so you can decide for yourself if they're really equivalent or not. That I formed my own opinions on the subject of Coke Zero, which is one of the things, I suppose, by pure volume, it must be the largest food or drink stuff I consume in my life. And I probably run over a gallon a day on average. And as far as I can tell, there's not a big difference between Coke Zero and the generic brand that one of the local supermarkets has. But if you could, you might think about that. I mean, that's the way that occurred to you. You might think more generally of how you, what I want you really to be thinking about is how we discover facts. Because a whole lot of issues that that lawyers worry about really depend on the magnitude of facts. So let me start with something I was involved in back when I was in Chicago. A colleague, I was a faculty fellow, not a professor, but meant I could spend all my time writing articles and just teach courses once in a while. And Steve Schulhofer, who was a faculty member, came to me with an idea. And the idea was that one ought to have a voucher system for providing attorneys for indigent felony defendants. That the situation, as you may know, is that under current law, if you are charged with a felony and are indigent, the government is supposed to provide you with a lawyer. Which sounds very nice, but one implication of that is that in a majority of all U.S. felony trials, the defense attorney is working for the government. All right, that's a literally correct statement. That's who he's paying him. And that's sort of a scary idea if you think about it. We're supposed to have an adversary system. Now, some of those defense attorneys may be public defenders who have an ideological or professional commitment to trying to get to do a good job for their clients. Others are attorneys who were appointed to the job by the judge at a low salary and whose only interest is in spending as little time and effort on it as possible. And the best way of doing that is to persuade their client to confess to something maybe on a plea bargain instead of having to have a trial. And there was at least one scandal back when we were doing the article, which is why I noticed it, where it was pretty clear that attorneys were bribing judges by campaign contributions in order to be assigned this, the implication being that however little you paid them, they could always do less work than that. Because in general, the payment for people who are appointed to defend indigents isn't very high. And so Steve's idea was very simple. It was that if you want to provide the attorney, but you want the attorney to act in the interest of his, quote, client rather than his paymaster, the client ought to choose the attorney. So just as various people argue for a voucher system for schooling, where we say if you go to a non-government school, you get a check for what the government would have spent on the public school. So Steve said, if you hire your own attorney, you should get whatever the amount get to pay him whatever the amount is the government is willing to spend. And Steve, there's been a lot of controversy with regard to this over the idea that the payments are very low, and Steve's point is, well, that's a very interesting issue, but this is a separate issue. Whatever amount you're willing to spend, it ought to be chosen by the client. And he came to me, and it was sort of fun because Steve was seen, I think, as towards the left end of that department, and I was on the other end of the department, and here we were jointly writing out, because I agreed with him. I thought it was a good point. It was right. And I at least like to claim that the high point of that controversy was when we gave a workshop at University of Chicago Law School, and I listened to Steve Schulhofer preaching to Judge Posner about the virtues of the free market, which was sort of fun. But in any case, the real point I wanted to make is that in the course of that discussion, one of the really important issues is what percentage of people who are convicted are innocent. All right, that if you believe that only very rarely does an innocent person get railroaded or whatever into prison, then you say improving the defense provided really isn't a very important issue. And you might even say, look, the only effect of your proposal, even if the clients do a good job, it just means it'll take longer to convict guilty people and we'll acquit more guilty people because they'll have better lawyers. And I should say Posner came pretty close to that position, as Posner's view basically, as best I recall, was that he didn't think, he thought it was very uncommon for innocent people to be convicted of felonies, that occasionally they might not have committed the felony that they were convicted of, but that the police basically knew who the criminals were. I was reminded of the classic line from Casablanca, round up the usual suspects. And my impression, though I may be wrong, is that Posner's real belief was that for some categories of crime, the police more or less knew who did it, or at least who did that kind of crime, and were very unlikely to arrest somebody who didn't. Whereas, on the other hand, during that period, Steve kept turning up news stories where it turned out somebody had been in jail for 20 years and then someone else confesses to the crime. Or I guess when we started getting DNA testing, there were a bunch of things of that sort. But my real point is that it is important what the numbers are. It would be really nice if we had a rough estimate of the rate of false positives in the criminal justice system, of what percentage of the people who are convicted are innocent. It would also be nice to have the other side as well, what percentage of people who are acquitted are guilty. We don't. And I've had some ideas, which I never got anybody else to really follow up on, for how you might be able to deduce that, but it's not an easy problem. And it applies in a whole bunch of other issues, that if you think about things like FDA regulation of drugs, and the argument in favor of it is we don't want drugs that will have bad side effects to get released to the public. On the other hand, it surely raises the cost of drugs and makes it take longer for them to be introduced. You'd like to know how big those effects are. All right? If the effect of the FDA is that medical drugs cost 10 times as much as they otherwise would, you might be willing to put up with, you know, a certain number of thalidomide babies in exchange for reducing by a factor of 10 that expense. Might not be worth thinking. On the other hand, if it's only 2%, who cares? And there has actually been, there's a classic paper by Steve Peltzman, on the effect of a particular increase in the legal requirements for drug approval, where his conclusion was that it had no effect at all on average quality and reduced the rate at which new drugs were being introduced roughly in half. And basically, this was a requirement. Now, it wasn't a safety issue, really. The requirement was basically that you had to have evidence that the new drug was an improvement on old drugs before you were allowed to release it. And the argument was, well, if that was working, if the companies were succeeding in bringing out useless new drugs, as it were, then this requirement should mean the average quality of drugs went up. And Steve had a number of proxy measures for the average quality of drugs, and he couldn't tell that there was any effect at all. But he also had a measure of the rate at which they were introduced, and that was a very sharp effect. And there are going to be a lot of other issues. Let me take one which I happen to have come across, because it's one where it turns out the public opinion is wildly wrong. And that's how much of the U.S. budget goes to foreign aid. All right? If you think about budget controversies, if you believe that the U.S. is spending a quarter of its money giving it to foreign countries and you don't much like giving money to foreign countries, you go, great, we can solve the deficit problem, no trouble at all, just cut the foreign aid. If the number is really like a half of a percent, I think it's probably less than that, I'm not sure, but it's not a very large number, then whether you're for or against it, I would argue that my arguments against foreign aid are mostly they do damage to the recipients, not that they cost us a lot of money. But it's going to affect it a lot. And I remember seeing some polling data where it turned out a lot of people wildly overestimate the scale of that particular expenditure. But there are lots of other cases. Let me take one which came up in, I have a course I've sometimes taught on legal issues of the 21st century. And one of the many different issues that came up was the fact that we have all long taken it for granted in language, law, and everything else that everybody is either male or female. It's not true, of course. It's untrue in several different ways. First, there is a small percentage of hermaphrodites. And second, there is a significant percentage of people who genetically are neither XX nor XY. I could go into details. The XXY is the most common, and XXY looks male but probably can't father children and is likely to have certain odd, not likely, a significant minority of them have various odd physical characteristics and so forth. And there are a number of other things of that sort. So that raises complications for law. I had a very good paper a student did on sort of how you fit the fact that our simple binary classification isn't quite right into law and other things. And of course, the genetic one is only one of them. You've got the people who, in effect, say, I am a man's mind in a woman's body or a woman's mind in a man's body, and some of them get surgically altered to change that, including one moderately prominent economist, as it happens, who tells the story that when he went into his department chairman's office to say that he had decided to become a she, the department chairman said, wonderful, we can get one more woman and one less man, and we don't have to hire or fire anybody. But that's McCloskey, who's a really interesting, weird, crazy person, who writes interesting things, as long as the books are too long, in my opinion. But in any case, but again, how you look at these issues is very different if you say this is one person in 1,000 than if you say it's one person in 10. And in fact, it's probably in between those numbers. You've been through a lot of other issues of that sort, and so I think it's worth thinking about how do you find stuff out? Because an awful lot of our beliefs are based on very, very bad evidence. They're based on sort of what everybody knows, what everybody knows is frequently wrong. Which is why I was suggesting as an interesting research project this fairly simple question, can we get some rough idea of how much advertising contributes to the cost of production? One sort of warning if you're doing the academic research, and this is something which I was actually maybe doing a blog post on because of a different issue of this sort where it comes up, and that's distrust outlier data. And I'm thinking of the following situation. Suppose you are an assistant professor at a third-rate school, and suppose you publish a piece of research which purports to show that some problem is 20 times bigger than everybody else thinks it is. If you do a reasonably convincing job, it makes the front page of the New York Times. You get an offer to be a full professor at a second-rate university. All right, that there is a real incentive in the academic world to produce results that are sizably different from the existing results on something people care about. Doesn't matter if it's something that nobody cares about. And my guess is that it's less of a problem if it's done by somebody who's already at Harvard or Chicago, because he can't get promoted to a better university because there aren't better universities. And he is at greater risk, I think, of suffering a reputational loss if critics say, can point out and say, here's the evidence, what you're saying is wrong. But person of the third rate, you know, if you're at a third, if, in the case I've described, I predict that if you publish the article, it makes the front page of the New York Times, and critics tear it apart, you'll get a promotion. Because for that university, just being visible is worth more than whether people who actually are seriously involved think well or, I mean, before this happened, nobody ever heard of you, so you're not losing anything from that standpoint. So anyway, so distrust anomalous data. If you've got a particular question and there are 15 reports, one of which gives a very different number, be suspicious of that one. Look at it if possible. Maybe you can figure out where it comes from. And in general, if you're looking at academic reports, don't just look at the conclusion. Because very often, in my experience, if you really trace it back, it turns out that that things people assert have very fragile bases. That somebody makes an assertion about the whole country based on a study at one college, to take one example. Or they make an assertion about something based on a definition of the phenomenon which is much broader than what most people use the word to mean, and thus get much larger numbers, which is the point of doing that and so forth. So anyway, those are sort of general things. They aren't about IP in particular, but they are about stuff that ought to matter to you as people who are going to be lawyers and similar activities. So before we go on, yes?
Going back to the FDA and yes. I was wondering why can't they just have kind of an improvement in the recommendation sense rather than nobody
yes. Yeah. Yeah, this is the same argument as with regard to medical licensing. It's the argument about licensing versus certifying. That one level of regulation is to say you can't do something. The other is to say you've got to tell your customers that we say you shouldn't do it. So you could imagine a situation for medical licensing where it was perfectly legal to practice medicine without a license, but you had to have a sign on your door which said unlicensed practitioner. All right? Or uncertified, probably wouldn't call it licensed, uncertified practitioner. And the argument that goes on that one, but also I think on the FDA one, is that the argument on the one hand is the claim that the customers are going to be stupid and make a mistake, but the argument on the other hand is, can we really trust whoever is doing the licensing to act in our interest? And that's an interesting one, because in the case of medical licensing, I think there's quite good evidence that the AMA over a long period of time used medical licensing to hold down the number of physicians. It's a very sensible strategy in any profession if you can do it. Once you're in, reduce competition as far as you can. So then you have to say, are the costs of the licensing being done not in your interest worse than the costs of your failing to correctly perceive your interests in doing it? And similarly in the FDA case, that in a sense the case where the FDA's position is really the hardest to defend is the case of people who are dying of something for which the conventional treatment doesn't exist. All right, so you have somebody who's been told by his doctor, there is no approved treatment in which I will predict you will be alive 6 months from now. And then the argument is those people should be allowed to try any crazy treatment they want. There's no serious downside risk. And not only might it save their lives, it might give us information. It might turn out that some of the crazy treatments actually work. And if you have a crazy treatment that works half the time, that's a whole lot, or even a tenth of the time, it's a whole lot better than a death sentence. So that's... But that would be at one extreme, and the other extreme is the thalidomide case, where you have something which is prior to the current regulations, which gets used fairly widely, and then produces very undesirable results. In Europe, I don't know if it was any, I think in the U.S. was a case where the U.S., it was banned on what a priori doesn't look like very good grounds, banned is the wrong term, it hadn't been approved yet, I think it was approved in Europe and produced bad results, and that looked like an argument in favor of the U.S. restrictions, if I remember the facts correctly.
I'm wondering if you could supplement that with some kind of tort theory that says, if you haven't gone through, if you haven't been told that it's really experimental and you haven't done the proper experimentation, then you should be able to be held liable.
Yeah, the problem, but under ordinary theories, you would think that the seller would then simply insist on some sort of a waiver such that you would assume the risk, right? Suppose the seller says to me, here is the medicine that we think is going to cure you, and FDA hasn't approved it yet, unfortunately, it's still experimental. I can only provide it to you if you will sign this paper saying I know it's risky. And
in the case that you said, that was the one where it's treating one sickness or
right?
So I'm wondering if they had that information that this is risky, that the second they're really with that thoroughly.
But remember that risky doesn't mean that they didn't know at the point when they were taking it that it had a risk of producing birth defects.
Right.
It was just it hadn't been tested well enough to be sure it didn't have any risks.
Right.
So I'm not sure. Part of the question really would be how common things like thalidomide turned out to be. Right, if it turns out that it's sort of a one in a million risk, then people may say, well, yes, I know you say it's risky. I mean, I sign an awful lot of click wrap, things online where my basic view is if this company really wants to swindle me, they can always refuse to sell me their product. And therefore, I'd rather distrust their reputation than worry about whether I've given them permission. I think that might happen. So it's not easy. Thalidomide is an interesting case because I've at least seen the assertion that thalidomide is still not approved in spite of the fact that on the evidence, the only thing wrong with it is that pregnant women shouldn't take it, and I gather it's actually quite a good medicine for other purposes. But you can imagine if you're working for the FDA and you don't want to be labeled the person who approved thalidomide, even if in fact it's the right decision. This actually connects with a talk that Kyle Graham gave yesterday at noon, talking about the way in which tort law is affected and perhaps distorted by the kind of case that seems sort of like the perfect case. Like, where the perfect case could be the perfect case either in the sense that it has a really sympathetic victim, or in the fact that it raises some interesting logical issue that gets into the case books. All right, so that, for example, one of the things I discuss in my law's order is the rather implausible situation where two hunters simultaneously shoot a third, both shots being lethal, one through the heart and one through the head. But it's a really interesting question if you think about what causation means. Because you could say neither of them killed him, because after all, for example, each of them, if you talk about but-for causation, in each case if the one hadn't done it, the other one would have. So cases like that get a lot of attention, and he was suggesting that the result sometimes is you establish legal rules which are the right rule for that case, but a bad rule because it's the case is so salient, as it were. It's getting so much visibility. All right, I wanted other comments, questions? Yeah. I wanted to go on to talk about, a different problem. One of my sort of least favorite cases in the drug area, which is somebody via Wyatt Laboratories, is a warning case. And it's a warning case where it appears to me that the reason why it was found liable was that the judges made a mistake that any intelligent high school student shouldn't be ashamed of. That the question was whether the warning was adequate. This is a live polio vaccine before they had the current polio vaccine. And at that point, the current doctrine was that it was an unavoidably hazardous medicine, that there wasn't a way of doing it that didn't have a very tiny chance of giving you polio. And the providers had informed the people who gave the shots, the nurses and the doctors and such, of the fact that this warning, that this risk existed, but had not made sure that they were informing the patients. And so the question was that adequate information? And what the court said was, well, the question is, having that information, might that be a sufficient reason to decline to get the vaccination? Well, they said, the risk of getting polio is 1 in 100, I don't remember the number, I'm making up the numbers. The risk of getting polio is 1 in 100,000 each year. The risk of getting polio from the shot is about slightly under 1 in 100,000. So the value, they're comparable, therefore it's an open question. But of course, the shot protects you for the rest of your life. So they were comparing the annual rate instead of the lifetime savings, which means that the actual cost, the actual benefit of, on their calculation, the benefit was about 40 times the cost. Therefore, on their argument, Wyeth was innocent, and yet Wyeth lost. So that's a different problem, to what extent the court system can reliably do it. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Congress eventually immunized vaccine makers, because it looked as though the vaccine market was going to disappear, as though the legal risks. So this wasn't the only case, but that was the one I happened to know because I got really mad at the judges looking at the case. When I told my sister, who was a lawyer, that I thought that the judges had been criminally negligent, her reply was, no, it was the fault of the defense counsel, that they should have. But, of course, I haven't read there. I don't know what they said. I don't know if they raised the point, and the judges just chose to ignore it or not. Anyway, all right, let's go on to advertising more generally. And then the kind of issue which we were talking about last time is, what is advertising? What's its function? And the simple function is just to give information. And then people say, well, that's all very well, that's a useful activity, but not very much of advertising seems to do that. An awful lot of advertising. It isn't really true that smoking Marlboros results in your riding off into the woods on a horse. And yet, that's what the Marlboro Man is doing, and similarly for a whole bunch of other things. And so then, what else is it doing? And then the answer, and the part of what I liked about Lippmann's piece was that she's going into it in some detail and taking it seriously, is that one of the things advertising is doing is actually adding an extra dimension of value to the product. That if it's really true that people like to imagine themselves riding into the woods on horses, and if you can get that imagining by buying Marlboros, then you're getting an actual benefit along with some risk of cancer and along with whatever pleasures you get from smoking, and that ought properly to go into your calculation. And I think it's true in lots of ways. I was somewhat struck by whichever writer it was who seemed to think that things like that didn't go into the pecuniary calculus of economics, because, of course, economics is not about pecuniary calculations. That means money comes from the Latin word from cattle. Economics is about costs and benefits. And also, in a sense, money is only an intermediary, right? The only reason we care about money is we buy stuff with it. So it's the stuff or the experiences or whatever benefits we get that actually matters, not the money. And from that standpoint, immaterial benefits are just as real as material benefits. In fact, you could argue that all benefits are really immaterial. There's a fascinating article by Gary Becker and George Stigler, who are Gary is and George was, two bright and interesting economists, whose title is De Gustibus Non Disputandum Est. Does anybody know enough Latin to know what that phrase means? It means about tastes, it is not to be disputed. And the normal interpretation of that phrase is there's no point arguing about matters that are a question of taste. But Becker and Stigler take it in an entirely different way. What they say is that economists normally assume that people vary in their tastes, that people have different utility functions. But it might be interesting to analyze and settle on the assumption that everybody has exactly the same tastes. What they have are different production functions for turning material inputs into what they value. So everybody has a taste for pleasure. But some people get pleasure from eating ice cream, and some people get pleasure from having sex, and some people get pleasure from sushi, and so forth and so on. And similarly, everybody has a taste for, I don't know, status or something. I don't remember that. And so, and the basic Becker-Stigler argument, which is an interesting argument, is we understand production functions much better than utility functions because some of them you can physically observe out in the real world. So therefore, if you could somehow convert your model into a model where we're all consuming ultimate goods, and all the goods you see out there are just inputs to producing ultimate goods, that might give you a more interesting way of doing economics. I'm not sure anything came of it. I thought it was a really neat idea. So in that sense, and I was thinking of the case of wine. All right, I may be wrong, but I suspect that a sizable majority of the people who drink wine could not, on a double-blind test, distinguish a $50 wine from a $10 wine. And yet they value. And if you think about what wine looks like, all right, I don't much like the taste of wine as a whole. But wine bottles are really pretty, right? And glass of, especially red wine. Red wine's not as pretty. The glass of red wine, a nice pretty glass sitting on a white tablecloth. That's really providing a part of the experience of dining, which is a immaterial part, but the one that people are obviously willing to pay for. So it seems to me that it's a perfectly legitimate kind of argument. And have I discussed with you the question of why anybody votes? Because that's the same kind of issue, that the reason people are voting is not the obvious one to influence the outcome of the election, which is why they say they're voting. The reason is it makes them feel good. And it makes them feel good because it makes them a part of something really important that's happening around them. People would like to feel a part of important things happening around them. It's pretty clear. So then the obvious conclusion is that this is an argument for protection analogous to the patent argument, and one which doesn't depend on likelihood of confusion. So the argument would be that suppose I've managed to persuade people that a particular graceful shape of wine bottles, which is the shape that my wine, which is a very expensive wine comes in, that makes you feel like a member of the elite. Then I've provided a real benefit. I've let people get this nice feeling that they're members of the elite. It's a desirable thing. I should be rewarded for it, and therefore you shouldn't be able to give people that same feeling by making an identical wine bottle. That would be the argument. Even if the label makes it clear that you're not really producing mine, so it's not really a likelihood of confusion. So that would be the sort of straightforward argument for the property version of trademark over the confusion version, which is really what sort of a lot of the intellectually interesting tension on this in this field seems to me is about. And Lippmann agrees with that. She does, I think, quite a nice job of making the point that, you know, the picture of Batman on the cereal box actually adds value for the kid and therefore ought to count. But oddly enough, she seems to think that's an argument against broad protection. She isn't arguing against protection to avoid confusion, but she's arguing that if that's right, that's a reason why, to take a more realistic example, why a baseball team shouldn't be able to trademark the identity of the team against people who want to make caps and sweatshirts and so forth, that there's no, you could imagine that the caps, you don't have a note when you buy it, this is not authorized by the New York Giants, if there is still a New York Giants or whatever the team was at the time. Nonetheless, the people want this immaterial feeling of identification with the team, and the argument would be, that gives people incentives to have teams that make people want to like them. Good thing, productive thing, and so forth. And Lippmann is arguing against it. And I think there are two halves to her argument, one half of which might be right, and one half of which doesn't seem to me to make much sense. And the half that doesn't make much sense is to say, well, if these say, yes, indeed, these immaterial things are valuable, but the fact they're valuable means we shouldn't give a monopoly of them. But if that's right, that ought to apply equally well to novels and inventions and everything else. And as far as I know, Lippmann is not in favor of IP, is not opposed to IP in general. That after all, why don't you say the fact that Harry Potter is valuable is a reason why other people should, without any legal cost restriction, be able to print up their own copies of Harry Potter and sell them and undersell the authorized editions. And it's also a reason why they should be able to write their own sequels, because that's going to give value, and so forth. And so with everything, all right? So that just seems to me makes no sense. The half, which might make sense, though, comes back to a point I made a long time ago, that there are really, in a sense, two different models for optimal reward. And one of them is you have a reward equal to the value of what's being produced, and therefore anybody will produce it for whom its cost is less than its value, and that's the right rule. Produce things when they're worth more than they cost to produce. The other model is to say the reward for things worth producing ought to be at least as much as they cost to produce, and then they will always get produced. So that, and you might say that has the further advantage that then the rest of the benefit of producing them goes to the consumers instead of the producer, and if you're a consumer, you might see that as an attractive feature. All right? So Lippmann seems to be saying, look, even without expanded trademark protection, there's plenty of incentive for Disney to create what Disney creates and the giants to create what the giants create and so forth. Therefore, you aren't going to get much more of this desirable thing by giving them more incentive. Therefore, you ought not to have expanded trademark. And I think that's if I understand her, I think that's the argument she's making. It might be right or wrong. I don't know how we find out, because after all, there's going to be a whole lot of different such things with different costs of production. And the problem with reward equal to cost is that it requires that you have some other way of telling what's worth producing. Whereas the nice thing about reward equal to benefit, assuming you can measure benefit, which you can't always do very well, but if you can benefit, is that then you spontaneously find out what's worth producing by what gets produced. And this intrigued me in part because it... Yep?
I didn't quite understand.
Sure. Two different models.
No, I don't understand two different models. But like you said, if you want to use reward equal to production cost,
yes.
Then you need to have some alternate way of measuring.
You need to have some way of measuring the benefit to know whether you should give that reward or not. Suppose the benefit of the product is half the production cost. You don't want to say reward equal production cost, and then it'll get produced, and that's you don't want it produced.
Oh, okay.
All right. So the advantage of reward equal to benefit produced is that it takes care of the problem of deciding what gets produced correctly, provided you can actually measure benefit of production, and patent and copyright are very imperfect mechanisms designed to do that. At least that's the usual interpretation of it. Right. And it intrigued me because it almost exactly parallels an issue in an area I've worked on, which is the question of criminal punishment. Because you can do exactly the same distinction of criminal punishment. One solution to the problem of the problem is, how do we deter those crimes that ought to be deterred? And in principle, we don't want to deter all crimes. There are some complicated reasons we don't, having to do with the cost of doing it, but the very simplest reason is that the occasional crime consists of somebody speeding to get his wife to the hospital or breaking into a locked cabin in the woods so he won't starve to death and so forth. So that's conceptually easier, although it's probably less interesting, less important case. So, but if we imagine that there are some crimes we want to deter and some we don't, we then say, well, one simple solution is let the punishment be equal to the external damage, the damage to other people your crime does, and then you decide whether it's worth doing or not. All right? Same rule we use for buying ordinary goods, right? The cost of the good, you decide whether it's worth that cost or not. So that's one possible rule. And that's a rule which you might put as the punishment fits the crime. And the simple version of that rule, which at least used to be the standard thing in the law and econ textbooks, even though it was wrong for reasons I've gone into elsewhere, is that the expected value of the punishment for a crime, the probability of being caught and convicted times the amount of the punishment, should equal the damage the crime did. All right, nice, simple rule, sort of like a hand rule for negligence kind of rule. But the alternative rule is to say enough punishment to deter. So after all, if we can deter almost all of the offenses with a $10 fine, there's no need to have a $100 fine. Now, the reason both of these, as stated, turn out to be wrong, if you really think into it carefully, is that they don't take account of the cost of catching and convicting people and punishing them. And if you take account of that, you realize that there may be some crimes that you would like to deter if you could do so costlessly, but they're not worth the cost. And there may be even ones that you wouldn't like to deter if catching and punishing was costless, but you want to deter in order to avoid the cost of punishing them. So that it turns out, I mean, I can point people at articles of mine that discuss this, but it turns out that if you really do optimal punishment theory right, sometimes the optimum is higher than the damage done and sometimes lower. According to whether you are allowing some mildly undesirable crimes, ones where the benefit of the criminal is only a little bit less than the cost of the victim, you may allow some of them to save the cost of catching and punishing those people. Or you may deter some mildly efficient crimes, some ones where the benefit to the offender is somewhat more than the cost of the victim, on the grounds that in order to deter them, you would have to impose costly punishments to you. So either way. But the basic logic of, do you get the optimal result by enough incentive to get the result, or an amount of incentive so the result will occur at the right time, as it were, in the right cases, is a distinction that runs through at least both of those, and I bet other things. And this goes back to why I was saying that one of the articles that we read, I really wrote myself, except I wrote it about criminal law instead of about IP, because it was looking at patent law and saying what happens when you fold into your calculation the fact that having something patented imposes costs. And that therefore, even if you need a 15-year term to get a reward equal to social benefit, maybe that last year doesn't give you enough extra innovation to be worth the fact that during that year, other people have to do a more extensive patent search to decide whether they're infringing. If all that makes sense. So, all right. A bunch of stuff, all of it related. All right. A different point that occurred to me looking at the articles on this and advertising in general is the idea that advertising is basically sort of a fraud, that it's just fooling people into believing things that aren't really true, or it's taking advantage of sort of human irrationalities. If you're interested in human irrationalities, I don't know if I've recommended to this class Thinking Fast and Slow by Kahneman. It's a really good and exciting book. Kahneman is a psychologist who got a Nobel Prize in economics and I think deserved it. And the book, let me go back a step. Economists assume people are rational. And the question is, why would we make such a stupid assumption as that if we actually know real people? And the defense I've always offered to that is that we don't have a good theory of irrationality. That people are partly rational and partly irrational. The rational part is the predictable behavior, so you work off that and you realize you'll sometimes be wrong. Kahneman is offering a theory of irrational behavior. So that's part of why it's an exciting book. But it's also a really fun book to read because he writes well and he makes the reader an experimental subject. That what Kahneman's basic thesis, this is not about IP, but it's important, so I'll talk about it anyway. Kahneman's basic thesis is that human beings have two forms of information processing, which he calls the fast mind and the slow mind. When I look at this room, I don't see splotch of pink there. I see woman wearing a pink shirt. I don't think through logically, how do I get from the image on my retina to an actual model in my head of what this room is like. And yet that has to involve a whole lot of image processing, right? If you think about the fact that what I'm really seeing is some sort of tannish stuff there, that's the table, a bit of silvery there from your nice MacBook Air, I think, just like mine. I think it's an Air anyway. Some pink above that from your shirt, all the rest of that stuff. That's not what I'm seeing. That's what my retina is perceiving. But what I'm seeing is all that stuff reorganized into an actual picture of the world around me. Ditto, I hear a voice of somebody I know. Do I say, well, by the frequency and the timbre and the pronunciation, that must be so-and-so? No, I think that's so-and-so. So that's a whole bunch of background processing being done very rapidly by what he calls the fast mind. Meanwhile, what we think of as logical thinking is the slow mind. And Kahneman's point is that in order for the fast mind to be fast, it can't be very smart. That you can't do very careful logical analysis of all of the stuff that's coming through. So you've got to have all sorts of rules of thumb, some of which work very well, such as the image processing one. Though even there, if you think of optical illusions, there are cases where our imaging processing rule doesn't work well. And others will work badly. And that therefore a lot of understanding what seems like irrationality consists of figuring out what the rules of thumb are that the fast mind is using, and then realizing that when you decide this question with the fast mind instead of using the scarce resource of the slow mind, which can only do a certain amount, you will therefore get a certain pattern of wrong answers. And there's an odd sense in which I could claim he's really supporting rationality. It's just it's a rationality in which thinking is itself an expensive input. And therefore you are, as it were, rationally allocating to the fast mind the less important or easier problems and to the slow mind the harder problem. But it nonetheless produces what we would think of as irrationality. And one example, which I don't remember if he gives or not, but it struck me as one that comes directly out of his argument, is a solution to a puzzle that's bothered economists, I think, since Adam Smith. And that's what we refer to as the lottery insurance puzzle. That if people are in favor of risky outcomes, that makes sense to buy lottery tickets. If they're against risky outcome, it makes sense to buy insurance. Why are there people who buy both? And that's not, there is a solution which involves assuming a rather weird pattern of people's tastes that would be consistent with that. There's no reason they just have that pattern. And yet it's very common that people both buy lottery tickets and buy insurance. The answer that comes out of Kahneman is that the fast mind does not understand probability very well. The fast mind really has only three categories: impossible, possible, and certain. Well, if you're looking at probability with that degree of coarseness, what's the effect of buying a lottery ticket? It, at a small cost, raises a really attractive outcome from impossible to possible. Big step. What's the effect of buying an insurance? The somewhat larger cost, it reduces a really unattractive outcome, your house burns down, you don't have any money, from possible to impossible. So both of those look like big steps in opposite directions, so both of them are worth doing. So that I thought was really, really a quite a neat result. Anyway. Yes?
Since like that poses kind of a problem for framework in general, particularly the idea that if we're going to see that rational, that to use both the fast mind and the slow mind, because there's a cost for processing it.
Yep.
Because people are not under duress by lottery tickets, they're not under fresh time pressure. So they can kind of sit back and think, okay, well, you know, the chances of this and the chances of that.
They can. On the other hand, there are an awful lot of other things they could be thinking about. Mm-hmm. That is, I think the argument is that there are some things like image processing which would be hopeless to give to the slow mind. But there are a lot of other things where you're really deciding between which one. That part of the fun of the book is that I would say he makes you an experimental subject. What Kahneman does is to give you a puzzle, and one of two things happens. Either you give the wrong answer, which is what the puzzle's been designed to make you give, or you start thinking the wrong answer and then realize it's wrong and think about it a little more and get to the right answer. And that's exactly, I mean, that's sort of really neat watching inside your own head to see just what he's describing. And I remember the example I remember is something like she describes a woman who goes to some very sort of what leftist is too narrow, but sort of what's the University of California that's a little bit south of here along the sea? UC Santa Cruz, right? He goes to UC Santa Cruz. Demonstrates for environmental causes, does various things that sort of get you a picture of this person. Which is more likely that she'll be doing 10 years later? Be a lawyer or be a lawyer who specializes in environmental causes? All right. Which of those two is more likely? What?
Be a lawyer.
You're using the slow mind. The fast mind just does pattern matching. The fast mind says, lawyer who specializes in environmental causes sounds like this person we just had described. The slow mind says, wait a minute, one of those is a subset of the other, so it's impossible that the chance of being a lawyer who specializes in environmental causes is larger than the chance of being a lawyer. So that's sort of, he gives a bunch of other examples, but they all have this sort of pattern. So it's really, I think, quite a book that's worth, it was my Christmas book a couple of years ago. From time to time, I come across a book interesting enough so that it's my default Christmas present for anybody who I don't have another Christmas present for, basically. And that was when it was, what are some of the others? There was Chimpanzee Politics. That's another book I recommend. It's a lot of fun because it's a report of very detailed observation of a chimp colony over a period of several years. And the basic conclusion is that chimps look more like stupid humans than like smart animals. And that was really neat. My very favorite bit of that book is the chimps have an indoor sort of cage area and then an outdoor area. And while they're in the indoor area, the keepers go past carrying boxes with grapefruit, what the chimps really like. And they go to the outdoor area and hide the grapefruit. They bury it in various places. And the chimps come out and they mill around and apparently don't see the grapefruit. And then they go to sleep. They take a nap at some regular time. And as soon as the other chimps are asleep, one of the low status chimps gets up, goes to the grapefruit and starts digging it up and eating it. All right, it's perfectly obvious that he spotted it when they were doing the initial searching. He knew that if he revealed it then, he wouldn't get very much because he's a minor mem. So he waited until they were asleep. Or that's human behavior, right? That's anyway, long digression. But it's a fun book. And I could tell you about my other Christmas books, but I won't because I've got other things to talk about. But it's sort of my highest praise in a certain odd kind of way. All right. Notice, going back to the question of to what extent it's sort of a way of tricking people, taking care of advantage of their irrationalities. And I told you the story last time about vampire video, that at least some people in advertising thinks it works less well than it's usually supposed to. As you may know, subliminal perception is completely bogus. That is, there's this widely believed idea that you can get people to buy a product by flashing things on a screen fast enough so they don't consciously recognize them. It turns out that was simply a fraud. That's the result of a study which, when people tried to duplicate it, couldn't be duplicated, and the guy eventually admitted he hadn't done it. But it's a great story, and therefore people believe it. But other cases, it might be true. But notice a couple of other things. One of them, as I mentioned before, house brands do give you another alternative. So if you really believe that all of this brand stuff isn't very important, then what you will do is to buy the house brand when it's less expensive, at least if it seems to taste as good to you. And it's also worth thinking about whether advertising in this way is any different from all of the other contexts in which we persuade people of things. That if you think about religion, for example, clearly a lot of the forces of successful religions is not rational argument. It's the music and the visuals. And, you know, if you think about a Catholic mass, or a whole lot of great music has come out of that. And I think that's true of a whole lot of other things as well. And if you think about politics, I think it's pretty clear that a large part of what makes people vote for one candidate or another has nothing to do with good argument why they should, but with why they will feel good about doing it. So in that sense, it's a fairly general point. But it also occurred to me, aside from house brands in this sense, there's another market alternative to advertising brands, and that's exemplified by Sears. That Sears, I don't know how important Sears still is, but certainly it used to be the major mailer, or the equivalent of Amazon, if you think about Amazon's current status, and still exists. And if you looked at it carefully, you would discover that Sears wasn't making the things they were selling. So you will have a Sears brand name. This is as Sears, or for some things, they would have a special brand name for their power tools, say. But oddly enough, it would turn out that the thing sold under that brand name was identical to something sold under a different name, and that Sears had simply bought up a bunch of them, in effect, and put their name on it, some contractual arrangement to do so. What's going on? Sears is substituting for the reputational effect of the individual producer, their reputational effect, and the argument for that is, look, you don't buy a power saw often enough to establish a decent basis for whether this company's power saws are any good. But it used to be the case, you buy from Sears often enough, so you can establish a basis for, is the Sears product usually good? And that, therefore, gives them an incentive to select, for them to spend the resources on figuring out who's making a good power saw and to put their Kenmore, I think, whatever their brand was on that power saw. So that's another alternative. And I guess the last point I mentioned, I'm not sure I have anything more to say about it, and that's the question of whether the web changes anything interesting, because the web clearly gives us a whole lot more ability to search information out. And I don't know. It also has the interesting effect of more and more making targeted advertising possible. And a lot of people object to that, and my reaction is exactly the opposite, that I'd much rather have people try to sell me things I might want to buy than waste my time calling me up to try to persuade me to refinance the mortgage I don't have. But a lot of these things, just sort of in terms of the world you're living in, is worth at least trying to think about whether it's changing in interesting ways. I was just thinking this morning when I was putting up the recordings for both of my classes for last week about what a beautiful technology it was that let me, with close to zero work, I could suddenly make accessible to the world what I had, you know, spent work producing, namely the talks, but the classes, but not the the actual distribution. I guess we're really going to be getting into trade dress and related stuff more next time, because that's the next chapter. But I did want to make the point that to the extent that trade dress is treated as trademark, if you think about the Coke bottle, for example, that does get us into the same issue as the depletion of the commons issue for patent, namely, if this is something that actually there are good reasons to do, you're eliminating one good thing somebody else might do when you turn it into your trademark, and that's also the issue that's the scenes de fair exception in copyright law, which says that if there's only one or only a small number of ways of saying something, then even if you said it first, you can't stop other people from saying it in that way. And that's at least the doctrine as I understand it. All right, let me... We've got a few minutes left. Go on to a general issue that sort of is coming up in all of this, which I think I've discussed a little bit before, and that's the nature of our obligations with regard to the law in the context, in particular, of copyright. Copyright is an interesting part because he'll have different moral intuitions about it. There are very few people who really think murder is all right, but there are a fair number of people whose intuition is there's no reason I shouldn't copy that. And various intermediate ones. I think there's not uncommon and pretty reasonable intuition is to say there's no reason I shouldn't copy it if I wouldn't buy it. I'm not hurting him and I'm getting some benefit. So let me start with the two polar positions. And one of them is it's right because it is law. And certainly a lot of people talk as if that's true. And the other is the way I like to express it is right and wrong are not made by act of Congress. It is right because it's right. For whatever, wherever you get your morality from, that's really where it comes from. And in that case, you obey law only either because you happen to think the law got it right or for prudential reasons because you're afraid of going to jail if you don't. And let me take a vote just on that. If you had to make that, those are two extremes. If you had to put yourself on one side or other of that division, is it that because it's the law, that means you're morally obliged to do it? Not maybe with no exceptions, but as a normal rule. Or is it that the fact that it's law gives you no moral obligation at all, it's just that some of the things that are law are also things that you're morally obliged to do, like not murdering people, and other than that, it's only prudential. How many people would choose a moral obligation because Congress passed it? All right. How many people would choose the other side of that? Right. All right. It's an interesting division, and I think, you know, I don't know how you want to just talk about it or just raise a hand.
Oh, I thought you were asking people to explain.
You may if you wish. I was just taking account because I was curious, but feel free to.
It seems that if people get to pick and choose whose law they want to follow, it'll sort of water down the legal system.
That was an opinion I once held. And the point at which I decided it had to be wrong was when I was observed that I was the only person I knew who tried to obey the law. If you think about it for a moment, let's take seriously your claim. Does it apply to serving wine to a 20-year-old friend who comes over for dinner? You're having a dinner with a bunch of your friends. One of them is 20. I'm assuming that the legal age for alcohol is 21. I think it is at this point everywhere in the U.S. Are you being immoral? Are you committing a moral offense if you offer a glass of wine to that friend, or a beer if he likes beer?
I think that my initial conclusion was based on a very broad sense. I think you can narrow it down to a few ways that you can choose laws that sort of damage other people in society.
But that's an argument against people picking and choosing moral values about damaging people in society, right? That you're now restricting it to the laws you approve of, aren't you? Makes it sort of easy. All right. Other people are welcome to discuss it. I was just thinking that it's worth thinking about and worth talking about with other people. Because, basically, back about the point when I was going to college, or maybe a little before that, I thought I was stuck with the problem that it seemed to me that I couldn't see any good philosophical reason why you were obliged to obey law, and yet it seemed to me that your position was right, that if people didn't feel that, the society would fall apart. And I eventually so I decided that I would obey laws until I could solve that problem, essentially. And I eventually concluded that that couldn't be right, because as far as I could tell, pretty much everybody else I knew felt free to disobey those laws that A, they didn't think were morally correct, and B, there was no noticeable chance of getting caught from, of which giving a 20-year-old a glass of wine, driving 67 miles an hour when the speed limit is 65, a whole bunch of things like that. It seems to me a very normal behavior. So that I would have said that what you really need is a society where there aren't very many laws that people don't agree with, and if there are, you'd better enforce them if you want them to be obeyed.
Just as a side note, that yep. If you serve an alcoholic minor, it's so expensive.
So risky.
I had a criminal judge, and it was around $4,000 fine. So it was pretty,
Yes. But it also depends on how likely you are to be caught.
Yeah.
Right. Anyway, so then there's, it seems to me, a sort of an intermediate position. And that position would basically say there's a presumption in favor of obeying laws, even if you don't think the law is right, but it's not so strong a presumption that when there are really strong reasons either to think it's stupid or to think it's damaging to violate it. And there's a quote I sort of like from Dick Armey, who was a prominent Republican congressman a while ago. And on the whole, Republicans tend to be anti-immigration. And his quote is, "I don't like illegal immigration, but I'll tell you something. I don't run stoplights. But if you put me out on the road at 2 o'clock in the morning on the way to the all-night drugstore to get medicine for my babies, and you give me a stoplight that is stuck on red and no traffic in sight, and I'm going to go through that red light." And that is basically his comment on illegal immigration. I think it's a pretty good comment because, in fact, the incentive for some people to illegally immigrate to the U.S. is a whole lot stronger than in the hypothetical he's giving. It's not just medicine for their babies. It's the difference between being poor for the rest of your life and not being. And therefore, even somebody like, presumably, Army, who thinks, well, on the whole, one ought to obey rules like immigration rules, would say, well, it's hard to disapprove of what those people are doing. That was sort of a neat passage. And in addition, of course, a further point is that sometimes the law might modify the moral obligations not because it changes the morality, but because it changes language. So if you think about a case where the law defines what terminology means. If you say what it means to say, "I guarantee this product," is you will be liable if it breaks down because of manufacturing defects. It doesn't mean you're liable if somebody takes a hammer to it. Well, if the law exists in that way, that affects how I interpret the guarantee you put on the contract when I bought the product, and that changes my moral rights. And you could think of a variety of cases of that sort, which don't fit quite so neatly into the categories I'm describing. Anyway, I guess copyright would be the obvious example for this. And again, let me see if I can think about the several different poles. One polar position is that violating copyright is wrong, and violating means you don't have a fair use excuse and such. And I'm including people who say it's wrong because it's illegal with people who say it's wrong because the author has a right not to have you copy it. So I don't care why you think it. So how many people would say that violating copyright is itself a wrong, something you shouldn't do? Violating copyright means doing the things that would be considered a violation under the law. So therefore, you could still believe you can do fair use. But if you say, take my example, what I think of as the intermediate position is going to be that copying a copyrighted work with no fair use excuse for, you know, you wouldn't have bought it, which I think a fair number of people would say would, and that on sort of a kind of utilitarian argument, that sounds right. All right, you're better off, no one's worse off, clearly an improvement. But if you say, but that's a violation of his rights, or if you say that's a violation of the law, which are two different arguments, then you say, well, even in that case, you shouldn't do it. So you could similarly, it's pretty easy, I think there are probably a noticeable number of people who would say that there are things you shouldn't do, even if they do no harm. That, I don't know if any of you followed it, but Steve Landsberg got into a whole lot of trouble by raising the question of whether a sexual act of which the victim was unaware ought to be illegal. There was this Steubenville case where unconscious girl gets drunk at a party, I think, and is unconscious, and some people engage in digital penetration, which that gets referred to as rape, though it's not what most of us usually think of. It's quite rape, but something in that direction. Woman only finds out like 3 days later. And so Landsberg is saying, why is it that in this case we nonetheless say that's a crime and should be punished, even though it would look as though there was no effect? And I thought it was interesting. I had a number of blog posts discussing it. And he wasn't, in fact, saying that it shouldn't be punished, but he was saying, here's the argument that makes it look as though it shouldn't be punished. What's wrong with it? And that was an interesting question. And lots of people say, look, isn't Landsberg an evil person for not thinking this should obviously be punished? But that would be an example where most people's intuition would be that even if it does no harm, it's wrong. And I think some people would at least say that it's wrong to trespass on somebody's land, even if you're doing no damage. It's sort of, and you're going to think of a variety of other cases where you would say where your normal rule of thumb is it's wrong to do things that harm other people, but somehow some things seem wrong even when they don't harm other people. So let me go back. So category one is the fact that you're violating a copyright, where it's, if it's fair use, you're not violating the copyright, is itself a thing that makes something wrong, whether because of law or because of rights. So how many people have that basic gut intuition? One, at least one. Brave person. Good. Let's take the opposite side. The opposite side is copyright. There is no moral obligation implied by copyright, either the law or the individual rights. And therefore, I should feel free to violate copyright anytime I want. Now, let me qualify that a little bit. I feel free. There are some things I feel free to do, but might choose not to do because it affects other people. So if I would say that I am free to, well, my wife insists that there are some colors of clothing that don't go together. And I've never really understood this concept, but it seems to be pretty widely shared. So I would say that I have a right to wear clothing which she informs me clashes. But because it bothers other, I'm not colorblind, this is an aesthetic issue, not a biological one as far as I can tell. But because I know it bothers other people, I might choose not to. Similarly, you might say, I am entitled to copy your book if I want to, but I actually feel that you're a nice guy, you deserve the royalties, so I ought to buy it instead. That's still saying copyright isn't morally binding. It's just saying there are other considerations. So how many people would go all the way in the other direction and say copyright, whether by law or natural rights, is not at all morally binding? You would respect it only if there are other reasons to respect it. How many people will take that position? All right. Several. Four of them. Great. So everybody else is somewhere in the middle. All right. Good. I just think one. Yes?
I have a question. So yeah. How do you extend that logic, your own position, to like issues of phishing, like PHI phishing? I mean, essentially the same things where someone goes and collects all these usernames, but it has no effect on the users themselves, unless they exercise the control of the usernames.
But presumably they are collecting them with the intention of giving them to somebody who will use them. So that they're presumably the final result is that I get more spam in my mailbox, isn't it? Isn't that what it's for?
Well, so the issue right now, like a lot of the federal courts, is that the U.S. Attorney's Office is trying to prosecute these issues of phishing. But they can't get anything that's higher than a felony.
Uh-huh.
A lot of times, there's issues of they charge misdemeanors only because the only proof they have is that they've collected this information rather than exercising it. And so a lot of people are advocating for a stricter sense of punishing these crimes, but
yep.
They were violated.
Yep. This, in a way, gets into the sort of question of in what sense we feel as though we have a property right over your own information. And that always struck me as sort of a puzzling concept because it looks like a property right over the content of other people's heads. So if you think about sort of take the case where I have reason to believe you can't be trusted and because I know some facts about you. And some people have a sort of a privacy intuition which says I shouldn't be allowed to reveal those facts or I should only be allowed to reveal them under certain limited circumstances. You think about our attempts to regulate credit ratings, for example, which I'm not sure they work very well. But the theory is that the credit agency is compiling information. It's compiling it in a way which in itself doesn't seem to violate anybody's rights. They're just asking, companies, have you lent money to this guy? Did he pay it back? And so forth, which they're entitled to say, you would think. And yet we have rules on how they can reveal it. So that's sort of an intuition of saying that facts about you are somehow your property. And yet that seems really weird if you think about another context, because, you know, suppose you're dating a girl and your ex-girlfriend tells the girl, you know, he's really a nasty guy. He cheated on me and he, you know, did this and that. Seems as though it's perfectly reasonable for her to be free to say that, even though it's giving away facts about you. So that's, yeah. No, I guess my intuition would have been that it's, if it's wrong, it's wrong only if it's getting used or only if you somehow violated some actual confidence in getting it. But if you do, take the simple case. Suppose the way you do your phishing is just to troll the web. All right. I, in fact, have my email up on my webpage. A lot of people try to conceal them in various ways that do or don't work. But suppose all you do is you've got a program which goes up on the web and it collects every email address it can find. Hard for me to see why that should be illegal. And what if you're doing, what if the reason has nothing to do with spam? What if you actually have a perfectly legitimate reason? You think you're doing research on email addresses. Maybe you're thinking of creating something like, I forget what it's called, but there's a procedure for shortening URLs. And you're thinking of doing something like that for email addresses, of saying to somebody, look, you've got your unique email address. It might be simpler if you could tell people just to click on the following four symbol things, which will somehow be a compressed version of your email address. Well, I need lots of email addresses as samples to figure out how to do it. Or you can think of other, maybe doing a psychological experiment, your research trying to figure out why people choose the email addresses they do. How do you see why that's doing anything wrong? And yet, if the way you did the equivalent of that was to pick people's locks when they weren't home, go into their houses, compile information for your research about the inside of their houses, doing no harm, making sure there was nobody there you could scare and going out, we would still feel it was wrong. So we do have this sort of set of intuitions. And it's related, I guess, to my theory about rights, which is that you can think about rights not as a legal or a moral category, but it's a strategic behavioral category, that what's going on is that each of us has certain lines which he feels he's entitled not to have crossed and is therefore committed to bear unreasonably large costs defending those lines. And that therefore, and as long as everybody recognizes everybody else's lines, and as long as they're not inconsistent, as long as you don't think you've got entitled to hear and I think you're not entitled to hear, you have a working system where I don't cross your line because I know you'll fight pretty hard if I do, and that I think is a more fundamental sense of rights than the way in which it's usually put. And my starting example is territorial behavior in animals, because when people claim that you only have property because the government gave it to you, they are simply empirically wrong, because we know that prior to the existence of the human race, property existed in a very primitive form. Because there are a variety of mostly birds and fishes which engage in territorial behavior, which consists of the individual in some way marking the territory he claims and then committing himself to fight increasingly desperately against another member of his own species who trespasses the farther into the territory he comes. And since a fight to the death is a loss for both parties, unless you're a lot stronger than the other one, if I know you're committed to that, I don't trespass. Does that make sense? That's observed behavior. Now, it's nothing like full property. You can't transfer it. It's not marketable, any of that stuff. But it is really a property. And it's a property of my sort. It's a property coming out of a commitment strategy. The commitment strategy by a pre-human, by a bird or a fish or something. I don't know how it works. And my claim is that property among humans is just a much, much fancier version of that mechanism. And if so, you can see that if you've got that line drawn, it really wouldn't do to say, oh, but I won't respond if you actually don't step on anything and break it. That's my line, and I'm going to keep you on the far side. This is relevant from my standpoint to the very interesting question of defining what a government is. Because people sort of think it's clear government, not government. Then you try to say, well, wait a minute. Every activity of government exists at some time and place has been done privately. Many of the activities governments do are currently done privately, like schooling, for example. Why do we say this organization is a government in that way? And the best definition I can come is that a government is an organization against which people drop those commitment strategies. So that part of my commitment strategy says, if you come to me and say, I am selling you this, you don't have the choice of not buying it, I will refuse to go along with that if I can at any reasonable cost. You say, and if you refuse to give me money, the amount of money I say for it, I'll beat you up. I'm going to resist that if I can. Even if the thing is something that's worth the money to me, and certainly if it isn't. But when the government makes that offer, which it does routinely every April 15th, I don't resist it. So I think that a sensible way of understanding how a government is different from another organization is that it's that organization against which people, for whatever reason, which have chosen to drop those strategies. And the term I used a long time ago was an agency of legitimized coercion. It's legitimized in that you don't treat it as you normally respond to people crossing your boundaries. It's coercion in the sense it's the sort of thing you would respond to that way if anybody else did it. I think it's a useful way of thinking about what government is. Anyway, I think we're about out of time. And even though we didn't have a reading, I hope we had enough interesting things to talk about, which is presumably one of the purposes of this. And we have one more chapter, I guess, which we get to do Tuesday, and after that we start having fun.